The problem with humanitarian emergencies is that they may lie in the eye of the beholder. Take away the requirement that military force must be authorized by the Security Council, and you have a norm that can easily be abused. If the United States and other states could decide for themselves that a military intervention in Kosovo was justified over Russian and Chinese objections, what was there to prevent China from asserting that humanitarian considerations required it to send Chinese troops into Indonesia or Taiwan? What could prevent Russia from claiming that humanitarian concerns required it to use force inside Georgia or Ukraine? As more recent events have demonstrated, these concerns were well-founded. In 1999, the United States and other NATO powers weren't willing to just look the other way while another ethnic genocide began to unfold, but they were equally leery of opening the door to unilateral state decisions about the use of force. In the end, the NATO powers decided that discretion might well be the better part of valor and opted to intervene without offering a legal basis for the intervention. NATO's justification for the Kosovo air campaign was fundamentally extra-legal in nature. It rested, in effect, on a claim of moral necessity. But illegal or not, it saved thousands of lives, and history has judged it kindly. Even the Security Council eventually offered it tacit, post hoc validation through a series of Security Council resolutions authorizing NATO forces to provide security in post-intervention UN-administered Kosovo. Still, the legal and moral dilemma posed by mass atrocities remained acute. In a 1999 speech, then-UN Secretary General Kofi Annan spelled out the conflict. "To those for whom the greatest threat to the future of international order is the use of force in the absence of a Security Council mandate, one might ask, if, in those dark days, leading up to the Rwandan genocide, a coalition of states had been prepared to act, but did not receive prompt Council authorization, should such a coalition have stood aside and allowed the horror to unfold? To those for whom the Kosovo action heralded a new era when states can take military action outside the established mechanisms for enforcing international law, one might ask, is there not a danger of such interventions undermining the imperfect yet resilient security system created after the Second World War, and of setting dangerous precedents for future interventions without a clear criterion to decide who might invoke these precedents? And in what circumstances?" By the beginning of the 21st century, the 1990s debates over humanitarian intervention had morphed into discussion of the responsibility to protect, R2P, a doctrine initially developed by the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, ISIS. ISIS consisted of noted scholars, diplomats, and former high-level officials convened by the Canadian government. And in November of 2001, ISIS published a report called The Responsibility to Protect. In its report, ISIS did something novel and in many ways extraordinarily appealing. It sought to circumvent the tension between the moral pull of human rights and the moral pull of sovereignty by simply redefining the terms of the discussion. In particular, ISIS sought to redefine sovereignty itself, arguing that sovereignty is not something that states possess simply by virtue of being states, but rather a matter of responsibilities as much as rights. And the most fundamental responsibility of a sovereign state is the protection of its own population. The right to be free of external intervention, long considered a fundamental attribute of Westphalian sovereignty, was to ISIS contingent upon a state's ongoing ability to protect its own population. A state that cannot or will not protect its population loses, to that same extent, the sovereign privilege of non-intervention. ISIS offered a starkly different understanding of sovereignty than that taken for granted prior to World War II. State sovereignty implies responsibility. Where a population is suffering serious harm as a result of internal war, insurgency, repression, or state failure, and the state in question is unwilling or unable to halt or avert it, the principle of non-intervention yields to the international responsibility to protect. ISIS was careful to note that military force should be a last resort, and that any military interventions should be authorized by the United Nations Security Council. But the Commission was unwilling to view Security Council authorization as an absolute requirement. If the Security Council rejects a proposal to intervene to protect a population, or fails to deal with it in a reasonable time, alternative options include action within area of jurisdiction by regional or sub-regional organizations, under Chapter 8 of the Charter, subject to their seeking subsequent authorization. Further, if the Security Council fails to discharge its responsibility to protect in conscience-shocking situations crying out for action, warned ISIS, concerned states may not rule out other means to meet the gravity and urgency of that situation. Logically, this made perfect sense. If the legitimacy and sovereign privileges of a particular state depend upon that state's willingness and ability to protect the human beings living within its borders, and if other states and the international community have an obligation to protect those same human beings, then surely any state that failed to act on that responsibility would similarly waive its own claims to legitimacy or to the full legal privileges of sovereignty. By extension, the same was true of organizations made up of states, such as the Security Council. Either protection of human beings comes before legal and political fictions, or it doesn't. You can't have it both ways. Within a decade, both the United States and the United Nations had offered the responsibility to protect doctrine at least a lukewarm embrace in speeches and General Assembly resolutions. And in March of 2011, the Security Council authorized the use of force to protect civilians both in Libya, where NATO took the lead, and in Côte d'Ivoire, where UN peacekeepers assisted by French troops used force to restore civil order following post-election violence. In both cases, the Security Council expressly invoked the responsibility to protect. This was the high water point for the responsibility to protect norm. After Libya and Côte d'Ivoire, there was a brief period in which various commentators declared that the responsibility to protect had finally grown up, achieving, or certainly getting within spitting distance of, the status of a norm of customary international law. That period lasted only a few months, however, for the Libya intervention soon began to appear, at least to critics, more like a regime change intervention aimed at ousting Muammar Gaddafi than a civilian protection intervention. Perhaps this was inevitable. It's not clear how an intervention intended to protect civilians from predation by their own government could avoid morphing into a regime change intervention in the face of continued government attacks on civilians. Regardless, the NATO shift toward a straightforward attack on Gaddafi's government forces triggered anxiety and anger in many states, including, most notably, Russia, China, and South Africa. From their perspective, the United States had tricked the Security Council into authorizing force for a limited humanitarian purpose and had then quickly moved to depose a sitting government. Even if the United States and other NATO powers had not initially intended the intervention to expand, the conflict illustrated that using force for civilian protection purposes could easily end up having unintended consequences. After Libya, the pendulum again swung away from norms favoring humanitarian intervention and the responsibility to protect, and toward an insistence on sovereign non-intervention, or at the very least, a wariness of interventionist arguments. This has been reflected in the ongoing UN debate about Syria, where, despite more than 200,000 deaths, the Security Council has been unwilling even to use the phrase responsibility to protect in connection with the conflict. In the United States, President Obama seems to have taken this to heart, as evidenced by his own conflicted response to the Syrian crisis. He's made it clear he has little appetite for a unilateral humanitarian intervention intended to protect civilians. He appears as concerned about slippery slopes as any U.S. critic. In August and September of 2013, however, Obama, trapped by his own rhetorical declaration that the use of chemical weapons in Syria would cross a U.S. red line, briefly declared his willingness to use military force for the limited purpose of ending Bashar al-Assad's regime's ability to use chemical weapons against his citizens. In the process, he articulated a legal argument justifying the potential unilateral use of force for the purpose of protecting civilians, even in the absence of Security Council authorization. The United Kingdom's Prime Minister did the same, asserting explicitly that a humanitarian intervention would be lawful under the circumstances. In the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, key surrogates, such as former U.S. State Department legal advisor Harold Coe, also advanced legal arguments justifying a potential U.S. intervention in Syria. These arguments were far from universally accepted. The response both from domestic U.S. constituencies and even many close allies was sharply critical. The British Parliament declined to authorize British participation in any use of force in Syria, and in the United States it seems quite likely that Congress would have done the same. Ultimately, this was not put to the test, as the United States opted against military action when Syria's government agreed to surrender its chemical weapons under international supervision. Despite the political backlash against U.S., U.K., and French arguments in favor of military intervention inside Syria, the 2013 debate marked an important turning point. It saw three permanent members of the Security Council explicitly embrace the view that humanitarian interventions inside other sovereign states can be lawful, even without Security Council authorization. Enter the War on Terror. The International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty had originally planned to issue its initial report on the responsibility to protect on September 12, 2001. The events of September 11th changed those plans, delaying the report's release by several months. Like the Rwandan genocide and the atrocities in the former Yugoslavia, the terrorist attacks of September 2001 shook up traditional notions of sovereignty, self-defense, and armed conflict. Prior to 9/11, most states had publicly accepted the general international law principle that force could not be used inside the territory of a sovereign state unless one of three things happened. The state at issue consented. The Security Council authorized the use of force under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, or the use of force was in self-defense following an armed attack, as delineated in Article 51 of the UN Charter. NATO's Kosovo intervention could be seen as the exception that proves the rule, a one-time, extra-legal intervention that shouldn't be used as a precedent. UN Charter provisions on the use of force rest firmly on traditional understandings of sovereignty. As long as a state refrains in its external actions from threatening other states, the uninvited use of force inside its territory would be unlawful. If a sovereign state chose to harbor terrorists, this would be its own business. Unless those terrorists carried out attacks beyond the state's borders, no other state would have a legal basis to use force inside the harboring state. But the 9/11 attacks made glaringly apparent the degree to which globalization and its drivers, changes in transportation, communication, and weapons technologies, for instance, had democratized the means of mass destruction, reduced the salience of international borders, and accelerated the speed with which money and materiel could travel. The attacks illustrated the growing difficulty in defining the realm of activities that was purely internal to a state versus the realm of issues that can be regarded as purely external. For that matter, the events of 9/11 challenged standard definitions of terms such as armed attack and armed force, long understood to refer to the use of traditional military force by foreign states. On 9/11, 19 men, unaffiliated with any state or military force and armed only with box cutters, hijacked civilian planes and brought about the deaths of thousands. It was hardly the kind of armed attack conceived of by the drafters of the UN Charter, who presumably imagined something more akin to Germany's 1939 invasion of Poland. But if the willful killing of thousands in an attack originating abroad wasn't an armed attack, what was it? Inevitably, the blurring of the lines between internal and external, and between crime and war, undermined the logic of sovereign non-intervention principles. The ethnic conflicts of the 1990s led the international community to define a state's predatory behavior toward its own people as a matter of global concern, and ISIS had articulated the responsibility to protect as triggered by a state's sustained failure to protect its own population. The events of 9/11 showed that a state's failure to control its internal affairs could lead to the export of harm to the populations of other states. Specifically, the Afghan state's inability or unwillingness to prevent its territory from being used by al-Qaeda caused massive harm to populations living far beyond Afghanistan's borders, the thousands of Americans and others injured or killed in the 9/11 attacks. Within the U.S. defense and national security communities, counterterrorism concerns after 9/11 sparked the rapid emergence of both policy and legal arguments for expanding the basis for using force within the territory of other states. There were several strands to these arguments. First, the traditional self-defense-based justification for using force was expanded, most strikingly in the Bush administration's embrace of what it called preemptive self-defense, which was used to justify the war in Iraq. The logic underlying the Bush argument was straightforward, though the facts, inconveniently, were not. In the age of ballistic missiles and nuclear, chemical, and biological threats, states may only have a moment's notice before an imminent attack. Surely the framers of the UN Charter would not have required states to wait for such an armed attack to occur or be imminent, in the traditional sense, to lawfully use force in self-defense. Or, as President Bush put it, "Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud." This extension of the principle of self-defense stretched traditional understandings of sovereignty, but the second strand of counterterrorism-based arguments justifying the use of force raised more fundamental challenges. The argument comes into sharpest focus when we consider drone strikes and other cross-border uses of force outside of hot battlefields. Since 2001, the United States has repeatedly used force inside the borders of sovereign states with which we are not at war, at times without the consent of the affected state. In October 2008, for instance, U.S. troops in Iraq crossed the Syrian border and attacked targets inside Syria. The United States has also attacked targets inside Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. In some cases, the affected states have consented to the United States' use of force. In other cases, their consent is at best questionable. While the United States has been reluctant to offer much detail or legal justification for these actions, the underlying logic used appears structurally identical to that underlying the responsibility to protect concept. Sovereignty implies responsibilities as well as rights. States must refrain from internal acts that threaten the citizens or basic security of other states, and must prevent non-state entities from engaging in such acts inside their borders. If a state fails to fulfill this responsibility, by, for instance, harboring terrorists, other states are entitled to use force within its borders if doing so is necessary to protect themselves or uphold global security. As U.S. Chief Counterterrorism Advisor John Brennan put it, "We reserve the right to take unilateral action if or when other governments are unwilling or unable to take the necessary actions themselves." Two sides of the same coin. The human rights and national security discourses appear to have developed parallel theories about the limits of sovereignty, though neither community is entirely comfortable with the logical implications taken for granted by the other community. One might even say that the responsibility to protect coin should logically be viewed as having two sides. On one side lies a state's duty to take action inside its own territory to protect its own population from violence and atrocities. On the other side lies a state's duty to take action inside its own territory to protect other states' populations from violence. A state that fails in either of these protective duties faces the prospect that other states will intervene in its internal affairs without its consent, and quite possibly without the Security Council's consent. There is a substantial irony here. Human rights advocates and counterterrorism hawks make rather strange bedfellows. The hard security community, historically realist in its orientation, tends to be uncomfortable with the notion that states have a responsibility to protect the populations of other states from atrocities. The emerging responsibility to protect doctrine has largely been greeted in national security law quarters as irrelevant or pernicious, likely to draw the United States into diversionary foreign entanglements at the expense of protecting our core national security interests. Meanwhile, those in the human rights community tend to consider drone strikes and other uses of force outside of hot battlefields as little more than extraterritorial, extrajudicial executions, a flagrant violation of international human rights and rule of law principles. Yet the logic of each sovereignty-limiting theory is virtually identical, and each theory reinforces and legitimizes the other. And Kofi Annan's 1999 warning still applies. It's all very well to argue that preventing ethnic cleansing and mass casualty terror attacks is everyone's responsibility, and by extension, everyone's right, and that sovereignty should not shield an irresponsible state from outside intervention if that state can't or won't take appropriate action itself. And it's all very well to argue that states and other artificial entities, such as the Security Council, can have no legitimacy if they fail to protect human beings from harm. But once you assert that every state can decide for itself that a military intervention inside another state's borders is justified, regardless of the Security Council, you're on a very slippery slope. This is even more true in a world in which attacks can come from non-state actors, and in which new technologies challenge old assumptions about imminence. If the United States can decide for itself that a single man inside a foreign state poses an imminent threat and use that to justify deploying military force inside a foreign state, there's no reason for Russia or China or North Korea or Iran not to do the same. In theory, all these tensions could be resolved if we had more robust, responsive, and accountable forms of international governance. In the age of globalization, we need more than ever a strong global referee committed both to stability and to human dignity. A global referee that could make those difficult decisions about when and where to use force, so it wouldn't just be one state's view against another's. Only such a system could prevent the inevitable erosion of traditional norms of sovereignty from leading to a slide toward conflict and instability at the expense of basic human rights. Chapter 15, Making the Military. A Recent Innovation. States make and unmake war, and war makes and unmakes states. But although evidence of organized warfare can be found throughout humanity's earliest pictorial and written records, and human societies have long sought to tame and contain war through law, the existence of organized forms of warfare does not require the existence of a specialized institution called the military. Far from it. Permanent, professionalized militaries are, like the state itself, a relatively recent human innovation. For much of human history, men, and sometimes women, assumed warrior identities on an as-needed basis. While elaborate rules and rituals often served to separate wars and warriors from ordinary peacetime life, armies and navies were assembled for particular purposes, perhaps to go on a raid or respond to an invasion, then disbanded until needed again. Until the 3rd millennium BC, there is little evidence of professional standing militaries raised, funded, trained, and maintained by the state. By 2700 BC, complex urban societies had developed in ancient Mesopotamia. Agriculture and the domestication of animals enabled the creation of surpluses, the amassing of wealth, and the development of what we would today call professions or classes: merchants, craftsmen, farmers, bureaucrats, and soldiers. Sumerian cuneiform tablets from around the middle of the 3rd millennium BC suggest the existence of at least a core group of 600 or 700 soldiers employed by the king. While the Stele of the Vultures, the world's oldest known historical document, portrays Sumerian infantry troops in helmets and body armor, fighting in elaborate phalanx formation. The Stele of the Vultures memorializes King Ienatum's victory over the ruler and armies of Umma. Their myriad corpses I shall make stretch to the horizon. And the stele, indeed, depicts Ienatum's forces marching past a pile of naked enemy corpses. By midway through the 2nd century BC, Egypt, too, had developed a highly professionalized military, maintained in part through conscription, each region being obligated to provide 10% of its young men to the pharaoh's army. Egypt was divided into military districts, and gifts of land were provided to families supplying officers. Military schools and training centers were established. Ancient Persia, Greece, and Rome all had standing armies, and the science of warfare grew more elaborate in many societies. In some cases, mercenaries formed the core of state armies. Throughout the next 2 millennia, standing armies waxed and waned in many parts of the world. In Europe, until the 15th century AD, armies were often hard to distinguish from roving groups of bandits, some of whom might be hired temporarily by local lords. Armies were generally raised for particular campaigns, then demobilized when no longer required. In 1181, for instance, King Henry II of England codified the obligation of his subjects to fight at his request. In the assize of arms, he specified the types of weapons with which each man must equip himself according to his class: hauberks, helmets, shields, and lances for knights; quilted doublets, iron headpieces, and lances for burgesses and freemen. The assize of arms required every man to swear he will possess these arms and will bear allegiance to the Lord King, Henry, and that he will bear these arms in his service according to his order and in allegiance to the Lord King and his realm. But soldiering was still a part-time activity and a purely temporary identity. Men fought when called upon to do so, but the rest of the time they returned to farming or trading or blacksmithing. Only in 1445 did Charles VII of France create what is generally viewed as the first standing army of any European state. Britain's first peacetime standing army didn't come along for another 2 centuries, and it caused an immediate backlash. James II's 1685 creation of a standing army helped cement the distrust many powerful noblemen already felt for him. By 1688, James had been ousted in the Glorious Revolution and was forced to flee to France. In 1689, the English Bill of Rights prohibited the raising or keeping a standing army within the kingdom in time of peace, unless it be with consent of Parliament. The poet John Dryden summed up the prevailing hostility to standing armies in his 1697 poem, Cymon and Iphigenia. Mouths without hands, maintained at vast expense, in peace a charge, in war a weak defense. The rebellious American colonists viewed standing armies with similar suspicion. In 1776, the Declaration of Independence denounced King George III for keeping among us, in times of peace, standing armies, and quartering large bodies of armed troops among us. The use of mercenaries and the impressment of American sailors was also seen as a sign of British tyranny. George III was condemned for, at this time, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, and constraining our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country. The American Constitution reflects the same mistrust of permanent military forces. It gives Congress the power to raise and support armies, but adds a caveat. No appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. Until well into the 19th century, the lines between bandits, mercenaries, mercantile entrepreneurs, lords, and soldiers remained quite indistinct, as did the lines between pirates, naval forces, and privateers operating pursuant to state letters of marque. Consider the British East India Company, chartered in 1600 to trade in East and Southeast Asia and India. Its first fleet was commanded by a former privateer, Sir James Lancaster, fresh from carrying out a successful piratical attack on the Portuguese settlement of Pernambuco. Lancaster served not only as general of the fleet, but as the Crown's accredited diplomatic representative to various Eastern rulers. According to Samuel Purchase's 1625 collection of documents relating to the voyage, the Queen provided Lancaster with her friendly letters of commendation written to diverse princes of India, offering to enter into a league of peace and amity with them. And because no great action can be well carried and accomplished without an absolute authority of justice, she granted to the general of their fleet, Master James Lancaster, for his better command and government, a commission of martial law. Although in its early years the East India Company employed only a small number of guards for its ships, personnel, and warehouses, by the middle of the 18th century, it was recruiting, training, and maintaining substantial armies, manned mostly by natives, to expand its dominion over India. In 1757, company forces under Robert Clive defeated the Nawab of Bengal, who fought with assistance from French troops. By 1778, the company employed more than 65,000 soldiers, far more than the British Army. From 1809 to 1861, it operated its own military academy at Addiscombe. The British East India Company was part profit-making corporate enterprise, part government, and part military, and it acted in many ways as the direct agent of the Crown. Throughout much of the first half of the 19th century, it combined its own privately employed forces with regular British Army units lent to the company by the government. Only in 1858, after the Sepoy Mutiny triggered a general rebellion against company rule, did the Crown finally dissolve the company, absorbing it formally into the British government. In the United States, concerns about tyranny kept the peacetime military relatively small throughout most of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Only during the Civil War did the size of the American armed forces for the first time exceed 1% of the population. In both the Civil War and World War I, temporary conscription brought participation in the armed forces up to about 3% of the population. At virtually all other times before and after the Civil War and World War I, the size of the military hovered at only about a quarter of 1% of the population. During World War II, participation in the active duty military shot up to about 12% of the overall population, before dropping to just over 2% during the Korean War, just under 2% during the Vietnam War, and about 0.5% prior to 9/11. Today, participation in the active duty military still stands at about 0.5% of the total U.S. population. If we add in reservists and members of the National Guard, just over 1% of the population is a member of the armed services. Since the draft ended after the Vietnam War, this population has consisted entirely of volunteers. In some sense, as these figures suggest, those who yearn for an earlier era in which more Americans had direct connections to the military hearken after a time that never existed on more than a temporary basis. Today's relatively low military population is not aberrational. It was the larger, conscript-based militaries of World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam that were anomalous. Of course, just as the British East India Company's private armies often functioned as agents of the British Crown, the U.S. government supplements its military with what amounts to a substantial private force, contractors. According to a recent Congressional Research Center analysis, contractors accounted for more than 50% of the total U.S. Defense Department workforce in Afghanistan and Iraq. Many other military and security contractors are employed by the Department of State and by other government agencies, including those in the intelligence community. While not under the authority of the Defense Department, many of these contractors function, in effect, as adjuncts to U.S. forces. In modern U.S. military activities, it has once again become increasingly difficult to separate the roles of private and public actors. Consider the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. According to press reports, the raid was planned and carried out by a mix of civilian CIA and DOD employees, employees of private firms under contract to the intelligence community and the Defense Department, and active duty military personnel. In practice, this too blurs the lines between military and civilians, intelligence and operations, public and private. What makes a soldier? Military personnel are as confused by this as everyone else. A couple of years ago, I was speaking to an audience of majors and lieutenant colonels at the Army School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth, SAMS. The school takes only those viewed as the Army's best and brightest, creative officers likely to serve in important leadership positions throughout their careers. Most of the officers I spoke to had recently returned from deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I asked them two questions. First, what did they see as the most significant security threats facing the United States in the coming decade or two? Second, exactly what made a soldier a soldier? The answers I got were interesting. I offered various options for most significant security threats and asked for a show of hands. Al-Qaeda? No hands went up. Islamic terrorism? One or two hands, but mostly I saw headshakes. North Korea and Iran generated no raised hands. Weapons of mass destruction? A few hands went up. New conflicts and resource scarcity driven by climate change? A lot of hands went up. Global economic collapse? Here, too, lots of hands went up. I moved on to what makes a soldier, asking for thoughts from the assembled officers. Some of the answers I got were tautological. A soldier is someone who serves in the army. And an army? An army is a force made up of soldiers. Others were more functional. A soldier, I was told, is someone who is trained to fight in wars. What, I asked, does it mean to fight in wars? The answers to this one brought us around to the question of how to define war, and most of the officers answered that the fighting done by soldiers is A, in the service of the nation, and B, involves the use of weapons that can injure or kill human beings or physically destroy property. Soldiers, they seemed to be telling me, are people who train to use and actually use weapons to kill or injure enemies of their country. Straightforward enough until I asked each of them to tell me how they had spent their most recent deployments. Most answered as I had expected. They had supervised the building of wells, sewers, and bridges, helped resolve community disputes, patrolled territory, worked with local police, written press releases, analyzed intelligence data, engaged in cyber operations. A few of the unlucky ones had been in vehicles hit by IEDs. A far smaller number still had been in what most of us would consider combat, actively engaged with enemy forces. In other words, most of them hadn't spent much time doing what they thought of as the essence of soldiering. They had trained to fight, but found, when deployed in America's two most recent ground wars, that most of the time there wasn't much call for fighting. What then made them different from police officers, I asked, or from the armed employees of Blackwater and Triple Canopy, who often worked alongside military personnel in conflict zones, and were also trained to fight, if necessary, on behalf of the United States? What made them different from the State Department's Foreign Service officers, or from local administrators or engineers? This generated an uncomfortable silence. Soldiers conceive of themselves as profoundly different from civilians, even armed and well-trained civilians. But those soldiers maintain a strong sense of cultural identity and inhabit a different legal order than civilians. The bright young officers at SAMS all understood my point. As the tasks we assign to the military expand, and as private contractors and intelligence community paramilitary operatives take on many of the tasks we used to assign to the military, it's gotten harder and harder to distinguish between the various players. What's more, if the military sees its job as protecting the nation from security threats, but the gravest security threats are things like climate change and financial collapse rather than war or even terrorism, it becomes increasingly difficult to define a uniquely military role and mission. These days, the tautological answers are increasingly the only answers we can agree upon. Soldiers are those who serve in the Army, and the Army is the institution in which soldiers serve. The military is the institution that plans, prepares for, and undertakes wars, and wars are whatever the military does. Chapter 16, An Age of Uncertainty. Stung by criticism of his foreign policy, in 2014, President Obama reminded an audience of Democratic donors that the world has always been messy. His subtext was clear. It's easy and fun to throw stones, but you try fixing the world. You'll find out soon enough that many messes are stubbornly resistant to fixing, particularly by the United States. He was surely right to remind us that today's tragic messes are hardly messier or more tragic than the past's tragic messes. Those who prefer their glasses half full can take comfort in reflecting that the recent Ebola pandemic had nothing on the Black Death, for instance, while the Syrian conflict pales beside the 30 years' war. But with apologies to Tolstoy, each era of world messiness is messy in its own way. Here's the nature of the current mess. The last century's technological revolutions have made our world more globally interconnected than ever. Power and access to power have become more democratized and diffuse in some ways, but more concentrated in other ways. For most individuals around the globe, day-to-day life is far less dangerous and brutal than in previous eras. For the species as a whole, however, the risk of future global catastrophe has increased. Meanwhile, the continuously accelerating rate of technological and social change makes it increasingly difficult to predict the geopolitical future. Nothing is particularly original about these observations. They're repeated in some fashion in every major national strategic document produced over the last decade. They probably teach this stuff to kindergartners now. Indeed, we've heard it all so often that it's tempting to dismiss such claims as meaningless platitudes. Been there, theorized that. Can we please get back to business as usual? Not if we want our children and grandchildren to live decent lives. If we care about the future at all, we need to do more than prattle on at cocktail parties about globalization, interconnectedness, complexity, danger, and uncertainty. We need to feel these seismic changes in our bones and understand that this is the perilous context in which U.S. actions are further blurring the boundaries between war and peace and further destabilizing the already shaky international order. So bear with me, and let's try to breathe some life into the cliches. Consider some facts. The world now contains more people living in more states than ever before, and we're all more interconnected. 100 years ago, the world population was about 1.8 billion. There were roughly 60 sovereign states in the world. The automobile was still a rarity, and there were no commercial passenger flights and no transcontinental telephone service. 50 years ago, the global population had climbed to more than 3 billion, and there were 115 UN member states. But air travel was still for the wealthy, and the personal computer still lay 2 decades in the future. Today, we've got 7 billion people living in 192 UN member states and a handful of other territories. These 7 billion people take 93,000 commercial flights a day from 9,000 airports, drive 1 billion cars, and carry 7 billion mobile phones around with them. In numerous ways, life has gotten substantially better in this more crowded and interconnected era. 70 years ago, global war killed scores of millions, but interstate conflict has declined sharply since then, and the creation of the United Nations ushered in a far more egalitarian and democratic form of international governance than existed in any previous era. Today, militarily powerful states are far less free than in the pre-UN era to use overt force to accomplish their aims. And the world now has numerous transnational courts and dispute resolution bodies that collectively offer states a viable alternative to the use of force. The modern international order is no global utopia, but it's a substantial improvement over institutionalized racism, colonial domination, and world wars. In the 50 years that followed World War II, medical and agricultural advances brought unprecedented health and prosperity to most parts of the globe. More recently, the communications revolution has enabled exciting new forms of non-governmental cross-border alliances to emerge, empowering, for instance, global human rights and environmental movements. In just the last 2 decades, the near-universal penetration of mobile phones has had a powerful leveling effect. All over the globe, people at every age and income level can use these tiny but powerful computers to learn foreign languages, solve complex mathematical problems, create and share videos, watch the news, move money around, or communicate with far-flung friends. We all know that this has had a dark side, too. As access to knowledge has been democratized, so too has access to the tools of violence and destruction. And greater global interconnectedness enables disease, pollution, and conflict to spread quickly and easily beyond borders. 100 years ago, no single individual or non-state actor could do more than cause localized mayhem. Today, we have to worry about massive bioengineered threats created by tiny terrorist cells and globally devastating cyber attacks devised by malevolent teen hackers. Even as many forms of power have grown more democratized and diffuse, other forms of power have grown more concentrated. A very small number of states control and consume a disproportionate share of the world's resources, and a very small number of individuals control most of the world's wealth. According to a 2014 Oxfam report, the 85 richest individuals on Earth are worth more than the globe's 3.5 billion poorest people. Indeed, from a species survival perspective, the world has grown vastly more dangerous over the last century. Individual humans live longer than ever before, but a small number of states now possess the unprecedented ability to destroy large chunks of the human race, and possibly the Earth itself, all in a matter of days or even hours. Today, there are an estimated 17,000 nuclear warheads in the possession of some 9 states. And though the near-term threat of interstate nuclear conflict has greatly diminished since the end of the Cold War, nuclear material is now less controlled and less controllable. If you want to give yourself a good scare, do some bedtime reading on bioengineered threats, or even the various possible lethal epidemics that might start without help from malign human actors, and then spread around the world in weeks, thanks to modern travel technologies. Then there's climate change, which could flood coastal cities, cause drought and famine, and fuel civil conflict around the globe. Amidst all these changes, our world has also grown far more uncertain. We possess more information than ever before and vastly greater processing power, but the accelerating pace of global change has far exceeded our collective ability to understand it, much less manage it. This makes it increasingly difficult to make predictions or calculate risks. For most of human history, major technological and social transformations occurred over thousands of years. The Paleolithic period, or Old Stone Age, is presumed to have lasted for a couple of million years, give or take. The Mesolithic and Neolithic eras got a 5 to 10,000 year run. The Bronze Age and the Iron Age each took a few thousand years. In Europe, things sped up during the Renaissance and the Age of Exploration. Enter the Industrial Revolution, and the pace of change accelerates some more. Today, in the age of Moore's Law, it's downright dizzying. For the average European peasant, life in the year 300 AD wasn't all that different from life in 800 or 1300 or 1700. It revolved around hunting, fishing, or farming. The manufacture of goods was on a small scale. Travel was by foot, horse, or ship. Most Americans living in 1900 would have had more daily experiences in common with Americans living in 1800, or 1700 for that matter, than with Americans living today. We literally have no points of comparison for understanding the scale and scope of the risks faced by humanity today. Compared to the long, slow sweep of human history, the events of the last century have taken place in the blink of an eye. This should give us pause when we're tempted to conclude that today's trends are likely to continue. Rising life expectancy? That's great, but if climate change has consequences as nasty as some predict, a century of rising life expectancy could turn out to be a mere blip on the charts. A steep decline in interstate conflicts? Fantastic, but less than 70 years of human history isn't much to go on. No nuclear annihilation so far? Thank God. But what on earth would make you assume we've solved that problem rather than just had a run of mostly unmerited good luck? That's why one can't dismiss the risk of catastrophic events such as disastrous climate change or nuclear conflict as high consequence, low probability. How do we compute the probability of catastrophic events of a type that has never happened? Does 70 years without nuclear annihilation tell us that there's a low probability of nuclear catastrophe? Or just tell us that we haven't had a nuclear catastrophe yet? Even when we have ample data going back over a long period of time, most of us aren't very good at evaluating risk. We tend to assume that the way things are is the way things are likely to remain. The mountain that has been there for thousands of years will probably be there for another 100. But we forget that the same logic doesn't hold for everything. We say, that tree in the backyard has survived snow and ice storms for 100 years. It's not going to fall down tomorrow. But when it comes to trees, having survived for 100 years generally means there's now more rather than less chance of collapse tomorrow. Lack of catastrophic change might signify a system in stable equilibrium, but sometimes, as with earthquakes, pressure may be building up over time undetected. Often, the problem is that we just don't know enough. If you just planted a new tree in the backyard from a breed that's never before been planted outside the tropics, it's hard to know how it will fare in snow. If you're a scientist studying earthquakes, tornadoes, or tsunamis, it's one thing to understand the conditions under which they form, but we still have little ability to predict their precise time and locations sufficiently in advance to do any good. Is global stability more like a mountain, more like a tsunami, or more like a tree? And if it's a tree, is it the kind we're used to, or a whole new kind of tree? Most international security experts have about as much ability to predict the future as you or I would have to predict next year's weather by looking out the window today. The events of recent decades should undermine everyone's confidence in our collective ability to predict geopolitical change. Most analysts assumed the Soviet Union was stable, until it collapsed. Analysts predicted that Egypt's Hosni Mubarak would retain his firm grip on power, until he was ousted. How much of what we currently file under stable should be recategorized under hasn't collapsed yet? We should try to feel the danger and uncertainty in your bones, not because it will build character, but because feeling afraid is the only thing likely to jolt us into action. Wouldn't it be better to try to actively manage the national and global risks we face instead of muddling through with our eyes resolutely closed? The United States in the mess. For Americans, the good news is that the United States remains an extraordinarily powerful nation. The United States has the most powerful military in history, President Obama declared in a recent speech, and measured by sheer destructive capacity, he is surely right. The U.S. military can get to more places faster with more lethal and effective weapons than any military on the planet. Even as its global influence and economic health have declined, the United States still has unprecedented power to destroy, as Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden both discovered to their detriment. We can kill, we can topple governments, we can demolish the conventional military capabilities of enemy states. We can wreak havoc on foreign states' economies. The United States can also destroy or undermine international norms and institutions. Despite our declining economic and political power, we still have disproportionate global influence. When our government embraces legal theories that accept the unilateral use of military force and destabilize principles of sovereignty, when we embrace the widespread use of covert targeted killings or indefinite detention or secret mass surveillance, we pave the way for other states to behave in similar ways. When we choose to bypass or ignore international institutions and rules we find inconvenient instead of working to create new and better ones, we further destabilize the already shaky international order. Against this backdrop of uncertainty, some of it of our own making, we have to keep planning and adapting. We have to decide where to invest our tax dollars, when to use military force and when to avoid it, which legal norms to advance and which international institutions to support or reform, and how to structure our military and civilian institutions. Like it or not, the legal and policy decisions we make today will shape the world we must inhabit in the future. Yet as war blurs and expands, the fog of war expands as well, making it harder and harder to see the branches in the road ahead. Part 4. Counting the Costs. Chapter 17. Car Bombs and Radioactive Sushi. For much of my childhood, my mother was a fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies. It's not surprising, then, that the 1976 murder of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt is seared into my memory. Orlando Letelier was a hero to many Washington liberals. He had served as Chilean ambassador to the United States under left-wing President Salvador Allende, who then appointed Letelier his Minister of Defense. When the democratically elected Allende was overthrown in a violent 1973 coup staged by Army General Augusto Pinochet, Letelier was imprisoned and tortured. Finally released by the military junta after intensive diplomatic pressure, Letelier fled Chile for the United States, where he became a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and an outspoken critic of Pinochet's brutal dictatorship. This was brave but foolish. The Pinochet's regime reach was longer than Letelier could ever have imagined. On the morning of September 21st, 1976, Letelier was driving to work. With him were his young American assistant, 25-year-old Ronnie Moffitt, and her husband, Michael, who sat in the back seat. As Letelier and the two young Americans drove through Washington's embassy district, a fierce explosion shook the car. Ronnie and Michael Moffitt managed to crawl out of the burning vehicle, but Letelier's legs and much of his torso had been blown off. He died within minutes. Ronnie Moffitt made it to the hospital but died an hour later. Only Michael survived the explosion. Evidence gathered by the FBI quickly pointed to the Pinochet regime, and it later became clear that the brutal assassination had been engineered by Chile's intelligence service, on the orders of Pinochet himself. Letelier's brazen murder, carried out on U.S. soil by a foreign regime, shocked the world, and was condemned by American law enforcement agencies and senior U.S. political officials, including President Gerald Ford. No one had any difficulty finding the right words to describe the incident. I have just learned with shock and horror of the senseless and brutal assassination of your husband, presidential candidate Jimmy Carter telegrammed to Letelier's wife. The American left was galvanized by the murder. I was too young to fully understand the politics, but I remember the shock and the grief. A car bomb planted by a foreign government in the streets of the nation's capital. My mother took me to vigils and solidarity marches, and we chanted in Spanish and English, Chile sí, junta no, and El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. The people united will never be defeated. At home, the songs of Victor Jara, a Chilean musician tortured and murdered by the military junta, played endlessly on the record player in the living room, along with the haunting melodies of Holly Near, memorializing the many victims of the Pinochet regime.
Hay una mujer desaparecida en Chile, en Chile, en Chile. And the junta knows. And the junta knows where they are hiding her. She's dying. Hay un hombre, hay una niña. Oh, los niños.
Of course, the Pinochet regime saw things rather differently. To Pinochet, the dead weren't murdered innocents. Chile was at war with left-wing insurgents and terrorists, many connected to Salvador Allende's ousted government. Letelier's anti-Pinochet activities made him a direct threat to Chile's national security, as the term was understood by the ruling military junta. As such, he had to go. Fast forward almost 30 years to November 2006. In London, 44-year-old Russian dissident Alexander Litvinenko ate lunch at Itsu, a fashionable sushi restaurant, then drank a cup of tea at the Pine Bar in London's Millennium Hotel. A short time later, he fell ill. He was hospitalized, but became sicker and sicker as the days passed. Eventually, it became apparent that he was dying, slowly and agonizingly, of radiation sickness. Traces of deadly polonium-210 were later found in the sushi restaurant where he'd eaten lunch, in the Pine Bar, and in the apartment of a former KGB officer with whom he had met earlier in the day. The authorities ultimately concluded that Litvinenko, long a thorn in Russian President Vladimir Putin's side, had been assassinated on British territory by Russian government agents. As a matter of international law, there's no uncertainty about the killings of Orlando Letelier and Alexander Litvinenko. It was illegal for Chile and Russia to violate U.S. and U.K. sovereignty by using force inside their borders. And since neither Letelier nor Litvinenko was a combatant in an armed conflict with Chile or Russia, the killings were nothing more than murders. The United States doesn't use car bombs or radioactive sushi to kill those we consider threats. Instead, we use drone strikes and special operations raids, and we tell ourselves that such strikes, which have by now killed an estimated 4,000 people in several countries, don't violate international or domestic legal bans on murder or assassination. We only target combatants in our armed conflict with Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, and now the so-called Islamic State, or those who pose imminent threats to the United States. But we don't make public the evidence supporting our assertions about the identity of those we target or the threat we say they pose, and we generally don't even acknowledge the strikes themselves. We want to believe that we have nothing in common with Pinochet and Putin. But as the lines around war grow more indistinct, it becomes more and more difficult to draw principled distinctions between lawful and unlawful uses of force. If we're truly in a war against Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, and that war and the law of war extends to wherever our enemies go, and if we have correctly identified who should count as a combatant and what constitutes an imminent threat, well, then we're nothing like Pinochet or Putin. We're lawfully targeting enemy combatants in wartime. Or alternatively and additionally, we're engaging in lawful acts of international self-defense against imminent threats, always assuming, that is, that we either have the consent of the sovereign states in which we're using force, or we appropriately view those sovereign states as unwilling or unable to take appropriate action to address the threat. That's a lot of ifs, and in a world in which the boundaries of war have become impossible to define, we can't be sure we've got it right. If we're wrong, if we're using force without the consent of the sovereign states in which we're operating, or we've incorrectly concluded that a non-consenting state is unwilling or unable to act against a threat, or if we've wrongly assessed as genuine and imminent a threat that's actually neither, then we may be breaking core international law rules on the use of force. And if we can't be said to be in a war with Al-Qaeda, or if that war can't be viewed as extending to its associated forces, or if we're wrong about which groups should qualify as associated forces, or about which individuals can reasonably be viewed as members of such groups, or if we're wrong about what should count as hostilities, or wrong about when and where the law of war applies, then U.S. targeted strikes are extrajudicial executions. In international law, that's a polite way of saying murders. High stakes. A vast chasm lies between the law governing wartime and the law governing peacetime. In peacetime, the willful killing of human beings is a crime, excused only under certain narrowly defined circumstances, such as self-defense. Even law enforcement agents are forbidden to use lethal force except in defense of themselves or others. The police, for instance, can't decide to bomb an apartment building in which suspected criminals lie sleeping. If law enforcement agents knowingly kill innocent people as a byproduct of using force against suspected criminals, we don't simply write off those deaths as collateral damage. Furthermore, the intentional destruction of private property and severe restriction of individual liberties are generally impermissible. In wartime, nearly everything changes. Many actions that are considered both immoral and illegal in peacetime are permissible, even praiseworthy, in wartime. Most notably, willful killing is permitted as long as those targeted are enemy combatants or others participating directly in hostilities. Under the law of armed conflict, individuals can be targeted based on their status rather than their activities. Thus, during a war, a combatant can lob a grenade into a building full of sleeping people, as long as he reasonably believes the sleeping people to be enemy soldiers. Even actions that a combatant knows will cause civilian deaths are lawful when consistent with the principles of necessity, humanity, proportionality, and distinction. Similarly, during wartime, various lesser forms of coercion and intrusion are also permissible, even when the same acts would be unlawful in peacetime. In wartime, enemy combatants can be detained for the duration of the conflict, and even those determined to be civilians can be indefinitely detained for imperative reasons of security, at the discretion of the detaining power. In wartime, generally speaking, private communications can be lawfully restricted or intercepted, private property can be searched and destroyed, and so on. If we're in a war, the continued indefinite detention of enemy combatants at Guantanamo is fine, and NSA wiretapping is perfectly reasonable. If we're not in a war, we're violating the provisions of a dozen international human rights law treaties by holding prisoners indefinitely without charge or trial, and violating a dozen other provisions through impermissible government infringements on privacy. What if the 9/11 attacks were considered an armed attack sufficient to trigger a right to use force in self-defense, but not construed as the beginning of an armed conflict? Here, the rules lie somewhere in between those of the peacetime and wartime frameworks. Unlike the international law of armed conflict, the international law of self-defense permits states to use force only to respond to an armed attack or to prevent an imminent armed attack. And the use of force in self-defense must be both necessary and proportionate to achieving these ends. Status-based targeting is not permitted under self-defense rules. That is, an individual can be targeted only if his current activities pose an imminent threat. Furthermore, traditional interpretations of the international law of self-defense define the term imminent quite narrowly, restricting the use of force to situations in which force is necessary to address threats that are urgent and grave, rather than speculative, distant, or minor. As we know, after 9/11, the U.S. government opted for the legal frame that places fewest constraints on its use of coercion and lethal force. "Our war on terror begins with al-Qaeda, but it does not end there," President Bush told members of Congress on September 20, 2001. His words proved more prophetic than perhaps even he could have realized. For once in war mode, there was no principled place to end the war or draw any meaningful lines between war and non-war. A global war on terror was a war that could, by its nature, have no boundaries, no spatial limits, no limits on who could be targeted, captured, or killed, and no end. Start with the lack of geographic boundaries inherent in a war on terror, or even an ostensibly more limited war on al-Qaeda. If we are at war with al-Qaeda and its associates, these individuals, whoever they may be, are presumably targetable and detainable wherever they may be. Following this logic, the United States has used drone strikes and other forms of targeted killings to kill suspected terrorists in states ranging from Yemen and Libya to Syria and Somalia, and has detained suspected terrorists as far afield as Bosnia and Nigeria. Limits on who can be targeted and detained are similarly elusive. Under the law of armed conflict, enemy combatants and civilians directly participating in hostilities are targetable and detainable. But who counts as a combatant in the war against al-Qaeda and its associates? Is it reasonable to argue, as have some government lawyers, that the Islamic State is effectively the same as al-Qaeda, despite the current hostility between the two groups, because ISIS was originally founded by al-Qaeda members? And what are hostilities in this non-traditional conflict? Further, the United States government has not offered any public explanation of which groups it considers to be associated forces of al-Qaeda or the Taliban. The international law of war unquestionably permits parties to a conflict to target co-belligerents of the enemy. On a traditional battlefield, it would clearly be permissible for the United States to target individuals and groups that are literally fighting alongside the Taliban or al-Qaeda. But identifying the enemy is far harder outside that traditional context, and executive branch officials have provided no clear criteria. Take three examples. First, an easy one. Say a group of Yemeni tribal leaders